Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 13th, 1998, and in the Koinonia Fireside building this evening, we have the presenter Jane Frankenberger. Her session number is 98-4. It's titled, How Do We Know Our Drinking Water Is Safe? Let's listen in.
Watch a video in a minute. I'm Jane Frankenberger. And this session is called, How Do We Know If Our Drinking Water Is Safe? Or how do we know that it is, in fact, safe? Because most drinking water in the United States is, in fact, quite safe. But we'll talk about how we know about it and why it's so important. I think all of us know the value of drinking water. I don't need to persuade you that it's an extremely valuable commodity. One of the reasons that I got interested in working with water is after serving in Africa. I was an ELCA missionary, among other things, for about 8 years total in Africa, and I worked in small-scale irrigation development, and I worked in a very dry area of northern Senegal. And although, you know, people, there were wells, there was the river, I mean, people in general had enough to drink, there was such a great emphasis on water, as there is, in fact, in any very dry area. You get many places in the United States where the main topic, the main political topic, is water as well. Most of us are probably on city water, on public water, and it's like the other utilities that we pay for and we expect to be regular. But I think water, even more than most, we expect to be there all the time. I don't know about you guys, but in my town, we have power outages, you know, fairly often, something like once a month or once every couple months. Does this happen in other places?
Not that often.
Well, you must not have big lightning storms like us. I don't know, we seem to have plenty of them. And anyway, and people know how to deal with them. The Purdue University, for example, has its own generator so that they can keep going. You know, they've got people ready to set up stop signs when the stop lights go off and things like that. So people are sort of used to dealing with that. But we're not really used to dealing with a situation where we don't have water. And indeed, it's a utility that almost never fails us. Although I did hear that recently here at Holden, it failed when a turbidity meter caused the whole water intake to shut off. So they really were in a situation without water, which must have been very odd. But in general, if you're on public water, you expect to have it all the time. How many of you are on public water? Rather than having your own well that you have to take care of, how many are you on public water or city water? Okay, so not all, but the vast majority. Okay, and that's mainly what I'm going to talk about. I'm not going to stress how much you need to take care of and do testing and stuff if you're on your own water supply. That gets even, there's more responsibility on you. But I have a strong interest in public water supplies and how our country regulates them and protects them so that we can be pretty assured that we're drinking safe water most of the time. But I think before I go any further, I'm going to show just a very brief excerpt from a video that I like because it sort of shows, it just reminds us of the value of water and what water goes through before it gets to us. So it's sort of a mood-setting video, and then we'll be able to open all the curtains and everything. It'll just be about 3 minutes, if this works.
When the earth was formed over 3 billion years ago, a remarkable substance so unique that without it our planet would be barren and lifeless. Water, the most powerful and important resource on earth. Water covers nearly three quarters of the earth's surface. Life began in the vast primeval sea, and the sea still harbors most of the species on this planet. Where you find water, you find life. times it seems like there's water everywhere. Yet less than 1% of the Earth's supply is usable fresh water. All the water that has ever existed on Earth still exists today. It never gets used up. Only recycled. It is a cycle with no beginning or end.
But there's a front moving in, and they're saying 80% chance of shower in the winter center. Temperatures in the
temperature. Eventually, all water evaporates into the atmosphere. And when the atmosphere can hold no more, it once again falls back to the earth. Water is the universal solvent. As it washes down our cities and towns, it picks up a little bit of everything it touches. The air smells cleaner because it is. As the rain falls over the countryside, it also picks up farm chemicals, organic materials, and bacteria. Water can absorb almost anything. Each raindrop is a tiny hammer that breaks off and dissolves minute fragments of everything. Even the hardest rock. Much of the water seeps into the ground. There it picks up calcium, magnesium, iron, lead, and other minerals. That's the hard water that many regions of the country have to contend with every day. The rest runs along the surface to our rivers, streams, and lakes.
Okay. That's our brief introduction to all the different kinds of things that we're talking about. How weird is the one that is the front? Okay. I just showed that mainly because of that end part where it talks about water being tiny hammers. Each of the raindrops is a tiny hammer breaking up that soil and being able to pick it up as it runs along. And also that water is the universal solvent. That's why it's non-point source pollution, which I've been talking a lot about this week, is such an issue, because water has that remarkable capacity to pick things up. So I hope that sort of sets the mood. It talks about the water cycle and all kinds of things that I could talk about, but we'll now skip over. When we say safe water, which is the topic of this talk, we mean both having enough to drink, I think, and having it of good quality. And so tonight, I think we have time to look briefly at both having enough water, that is water quantity, and water quality. And I have a little discussion problem having to do with each of those. But we won't like break them into groups and solve problems. But I hope it'll generate some discussion. So let's start with the question of whether we have enough water, and how we know whether we have enough water, and how towns solve the problem when they don't really have enough water. First of all, you probably know that water can come from two different kinds of supplies. It can either come from groundwater, or wells, or it can come from surface water, or which is lakes, streams, reservoirs. Something like Copper Creek, where Holden gets its water, is coming from the surface. But where you come from, it's more likely that it's from well water, but you may know. Across the U.S., about 50% of our water comes from each of those sources, groundwater and surface water. Now, you might want to just flip the thing so they point out, you know, with the bar. Well, don't worry about it.
Yeah, at least not to go with the other hand.
Okay. thank you. So, now I'm going to ask another question. How many of you know the source of your water? Most of you are on public water. Do you know where it comes from? Raise your hand if you know where it comes from. Well, that's good. Okay, because there's plenty of people across the U.S. that do not. How many have it come primarily from groundwater? Okay, this is a lot of Northwest.
Collected in the mountains and...
Well, no, that would be from wells. That would mean it's pumped up from underground, as opposed to coming out of a reservoir, lake, or stream. Okay, so we have a few on groundwater, but primarily it sounds like we've got people from those big Northwest cities, Seattle, Portland, ones like that, where you're talking surface water. Okay, that's great. You are blessed out here in the Northwest with, you know, primarily having enough water. But in many places of the country, as I'm sure that you know, we don't, there isn't enough water, and water use is a big issue. And so I have a problem here. It's actually sort of an ethics case study that I thought we could spend a little bit of time discussing, because it poses the sort of problem of what happens when we don't have enough water. I took a one-week workshop on ethics this summer that was designed for faculty in the life sciences so that we can get a little bit of ethics into our teaching. So I feel I'm treading very warily here, because my field is not, you know, ethics at all. But I thought that this was a good case study, and it had to do with water. So I thought I would just present this to you, and then as a way of discussing the issues around water use. And we'll spend a little bit of time on that. And then, as I said, we'll go on to issues of water quality, which also present very interesting ethical issues and issues having to do with community conflict. All right, so what we have is an economically disadvantaged town somewhere where there's slightly water short. I won't name a particular state. And they're desperately needing more jobs in the community. And they're talking with a very socially responsible company. I had to think of a really, you know, because people at Holden I knew would have a discerning mind as to what's socially responsible or not. So what this company is going to do is make fleece jackets out of pop bottles, recycled. Okay, so very environmentally sound. And if they come to town, they're going to provide 100 good jobs for people in this economically disadvantaged town. The only problem is, this process is going to use a lot of water. I'm talking hypothetically here. I don't actually know how much water it uses up. And the town's wells are already producing at their limit. So the only way this new factory could come to town is if they were allowed to use water from the river. Okay, but the public water is from the wells. Now, so the town council's plan is to allow them to start using water from the river. Now, the problem is this plan is opposed by two groups. First, there's the existing riparian rights holders. Okay, so that's people who live along the river, who in many states legally have the first use. There's many states where it's regulated by if you live along the water, that's if you have it. But we're not looking at a legal case study here. It's more what's right and wrong. But anyway, there's several small farmers who have been using water from the river for over a century. And the use has expanded and contracted, but basically they're doing watering their livestock and irrigation. And the state water board study of the stream flow says that if the town started pulling water for this factory, the farmers would no longer have enough. Okay, so obviously the farmers are opposed to the town letting the factory have some of the water. The other people who are opposed to letting the factory have some of the water from the river are a loose-knit coalition of environmentalists and sportsmen called Friends of the River. Okay, so it's a coalition here. And this river supplies sustenance to fish and wildlife up and down its length, including an endangered species of salamander unique to this river. So these environmentalists are very concerned that the salamander depend on having enough flow remaining in the river. So they don't want either the farmers or the factory to take all the water out of the river. And then, of course, there's the recreational use. That's the sportsmen. They also want to fish in the river. And so they are also opposed to both of these water uses. So let's see if you have some comments on whether the factory should be able to start using the water. I'll direct the discussion if it needs it, but let's just start out by throwing some ideas on what might be in favor of each of these possible uses of the river.
I have a point of clarification. Is the water being used up or just used in the process and put back in the river?
Oh, by irrigation it would typically be used up.
I meant for the plant.
For the factory. You got a good point. They need it. Let's say the farmers are upstream, and so the factory wants to be able to withdraw some downstream. That's true. The factory would in many cases put it back in. Okay, the complicated feature, that's why.
So they would be recycling?
We can't count on the factories recycling. Let's say for some reason they also use it up. I don't know why. Maybe they need to do cooling. Cooling, you'd put it back in. They need to have a spray evaporation process. So it uses it up. Okay, so all either of those two.
So they'll be taking the water and it won't be replaced.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Any general thoughts? All right, well, let me talk a little bit further about this with my very limited ethics background, but it was helpful for me to think about this. There are many sort of bases for ethics. We could be approaching this from quite a number of ways. I mean, bases, it's sort of foundations that different people follow for their ethics. And one that you're probably familiar with to some extent is the utilitarian way of looking things, where you're looking at the whole, you're trying to increase happiness or well-being of the whole community, the whole society, to the greatest amount. So you're trying to figure out, in sort of a cost-benefit analysis, that idea is always utilitarian, that you're trying to get the most benefit for the most people. So if you have a utilitarian view of something like water rights, what would you choose to do? Remember, you're trying to help the most people.
Right, the factory will work, yeah.
Yeah, I believe in that case you'd let the factory in because it provides so many jobs, and we only have a few farmers, so there's, and it's a whole community that's struggling, so you might be helping 1,000 people by getting the factory in, and there are only 15 farmers, something like that. So if you look at it, at life, if your view of ethics is strictly utilitarian kind of principle, you're probably going to choose the factory. Okay, another way of looking at ethics is a sort of a rights-based approach, that it's always the individual that needs to be protected unless that individual is doing harm to others, actual harm to others, then you need to stop them. But otherwise, it's a view that the individual human dignity is at the center of things, and we always need to support individual freedom of choice. That's sort of another foundation of ethics, if you look at things that way. And what does it seem like you might support if you look at it from that point of view?
All the farmers and all the original people have access to the water, which is people on the river, obviously.
Yeah, I think that's what many people come up with, that they had, they bought the farm, they assumed they'd have water rights, and they invested in it, assuming that they would continue. And you are hurting those 15 farmers, or maybe it's only 5 farmers, if you take the water out of the river. And then a sort of a newer ethical strain is looking at, it's sort of a deep ecology strain, which some of you might be familiar with, is looking at nature itself as having rights, which apparently doesn't fit well into any sort of classical model of ethics. So it's a new, it's a different framework where you're looking at nature. And that may provide the basis for the environmentalist saying that the salamander has rights. We don't have a right to wipe out that endangered species. So it provides sort of an opportunity to look at this question from several points of view. Does anyone have any other comments or thoughts? Uh-huh.
I read a book and I'm trying to remember the author. He's at Harvard. I think he's in the School of Forestry and Fisheries. And it's called The Value of Life, and it goes along the same thing. I didn't even think of being part of ethics, but he lists, I think, 7 qualities that people use to measure how much they value the environment. And he mentions utilitarian, and then he mentions dominance, you know, that humans dominate. There is a philosophy where, I guess you'd call it a philosophy, where humans dominate, and so they, since they have dominion, they should have the ultimate say, for instance. Mm-hmm. And there's one on aestheticism, that some people just love nature and want to go someplace where it's quiet and they don't want the infringement. And there, he had a whole list, I think, of these kind of parallels, what you were just saying.
Right, so it's helpful, right, to sort of break it into, look at a specific issue in the context of what your general moral theory sort of, or who of us has a moral theory, I certainly don't, but it was helpful to try and understand other people's point of view, is I think what it really helped me do. So this kind of a situation was primarily written, you know, for an ethics course to get at those different things, but I thought it was helpful too to look at water use. Here we are at Holden, certainly a center in the Lutheran Church of ecological thinking. I think it's been a gift to many of us to be able to clarify the place of the environment in what we value and treasure. So that might cause us to have a different view. What would you decide? Would anybody say? What would they decide if you had the decision-making power here?
Well, the thing with the salamander throws a
crook into it, because you could call in the Endangered Species Act.
Right, that would be the law. We're only talking ethics here. Okay. What's the right thing to do, not what's legal?
The ethics is to take care of people that are already there. Bringing in new people, they haven't earned any rights. They're coming from the outside, so they're not part of the community yet anyway.
Okay, you'd look at it that way.
Except the salamander was there before the people were.
Well, the salamander's doing fine without until the spike comes along anyway.
Yeah, okay, I'm not sure how that works. Yeah. Maybe the salamander isn't doing fine, that's why it's endangered. You know, it's only barely making it. We'd like to make it plentiful. We'd like to get it off the endangered species list. So,
I would want to look at the historical usage of the water by the farmers, and if they have recently been increasing their water usage, we might want to reduce that water usage to the historical levels in order to protect the salamander.
Mm-hmm. And no factory.
And no factory.
No pop-ups making into fleece. Okay.
If the factory would endanger the salamander.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I think I'd try some maybe public education, telling people that if the factory is to come, then the water consumption must be reduced per household, and then give 10 ways you could reduce your consumption, like using rock lawns instead of grass lawns.
Yeah, good point. Mm. Taking shorter showers and... If it's yellow,
but
as
the
we
problem
know
with the factory coming in is you're going to have more residents anyhow, which means you're going to be using more water because of the factory employing those people.
The consumption, human consumption for that is a fraction of what industry uses anyway. Wouldn't make a dent in it anyway.
It would make, well, a slight dent. I mean, how small a dent? Yes, back there.
There was someone, I don't remember the context, but talked about the seventh generation principle of American Indians. Decisions were based on looking ahead seven generations, what's good for seven generations hence.
Okay, and that would provide a basis for decision making too. It's a very helpful, very helpful comment that we don't look at. It's sort of almost utilitarianism, but not for now, but looking into the future of trying to look very long term. Yeah.
I might send the Chamber of Commerce back to the search table again and have them start over on their industry search to see who else could fit the needs of the community that maybe would not have that same environmental impact.
That didn't need water for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any other thoughts? I was just going to say on the seventh generation thing, we were having a discussion with Martin Wells, the director, this afternoon. I don't know if some of you were here, but he pointed out so well how the tailings teach people, you know, and should be used to teach people to think further ahead. Because the mine at the time, as I'm sure you've all heard, was a very safe mine. It was considered very progressive. You know, this community was so well, I mean, everyone was well taken care of. So it was looked on as a very good mine. They just didn't look far enough down the road to think, what about this 10 million tons of tailings, and you know, what are they going to be long term? So if they had used that seventh generation principle, maybe the decision making would have been different. So that's very helpful.
And I'm an accountant, and there's a theory in accounting that really isn't mentioned very often, but the question is, what is the full cost of a product? And the issue would be, well, they really didn't recognize the full cost of that product when they started taking it out of here. And had they done that, then maybe it would still be in the mountain.
Yeah. And so we need to work those full costs into our decision making. And for the most part, they're not. Wouldn't that be right? In a situation like this, there isn't an economic way to get at the right answer to this question.
Yeah, it was a resource-based economy at the time anyhow. So, and we just came in and, you know, extract it, and who cares about what cost it was?
The cost to the environment, there's no cost.
Yeah, but would the economics help in the situation of the river and the factory and the farmers? Does that offer us a way to help to make better decisions there?
Sure.
If you can really add up all the costs. Right. So maybe the irrigation is not as profitable as it seems. Would that be right?
Problem is, if we just keep cutting back on the farmers, we're not going to have any food.
that's a good point, because that is an easy place to cut, yes.
This may be begging the question, but what are the farmers raising? If they're raising beef cattle, or are they raising, you know, is it a truck garden? What, you know, what are we talking about here? Because there's this kind of situation exists in some places right now,
yes,
where it's very, the cost is very high to use land to, you know, for example, raise beef, as opposed to using it for something else. And the amount of water involved and so on is all part of that.
Yeah, I think that that's certainly right, and that could be clarified. And as a society, we need to carefully think about those questions. Well, we're not, that was a very brief, just sort of a slight trip down the lane of water use rights, or water rights, and having plenty of water. But let's turn back to then the situation that most of us are in. If you're, most of you are from the Northwest. I know I'm from Indiana. I don't know where else we might have people from. But most of us are from areas of the country where water is in fact plentiful, but we do have concerns about its quality. So that's what we want to think about for the rest of this session. And so I want to talk about a few things. First of all, how our country regulates the water. And then we're going to look at, we're going to look at what's happening right now currently with the Safe Drinking Water Act. Okay, the Safe Drinking Water Act was renewed in 1996, and many people were very glad that it finally got renewed. It was way overdue, like so many of our major federal policies, but it did get renewed in 1996 and came out with actually what most people think is, I mean, I certainly do, was a very good bill, because it brings in many new considerations, which I think will be helpful for people understanding what's going on with their water. There's some revisions, but some things go way back. There's many levels of regulation of public water supplies in the United States. The first one is monitoring. All systems are required to monitor at regular intervals for quite a number of things. And I won't list them all, but there's a bunch of general categories. But let me just say here that the frequency of monitoring depends, first of all, on what contaminant you're talking about. You have to monitor more frequently for bacteria than for pesticides, for example. But everybody has to monitor at some interval for all of these things. The other thing that it depends on is the size of your system. So Holden Village, that's one question I forgot to ask, what their monitoring frequency is. But I think normally for bacteria, they only need to monitor something like once a month or something like that. Whereas in Portland, Oregon, they probably need to monitor several times a day. So for bacteria, not for all these other things. But it depends on the size of your system, how often you're monitoring. But big systems are monitoring a lot. And that's one of the advantages of being part of a big system, because nothing's going to sort of sneak by you. I don't know if many of you noticed a few days ago that there was a sign up on the bulletin board that said they had found high turbidity here. Did anyone notice that? Again, I forgot to ask Martin. But I think what it meant was there's no problem with turbidity. That's not a contaminant for people at all. What it means is they had to make their monitoring a little bit more frequent, because once there's high turbidity, you have a greater risk of finding microorganisms, so they have to do the bacteria testing more often. So there's a lot of regulation going on if you're on a public water supply. Let me just add here, if you're on a private water supply, which are you? Mm-hmm. Nobody's monitoring but you, and that's why, you know, the big change here, and people don't always realize, if they have their own well, nobody's looking after it. And most people wouldn't want the government to be telling them how often they have to monitor, but basically you never have to monitor it, and nobody's looking after it except you, so all the responsibility falls on you. But that's not the case with a public water supply. The second kind of regulation that we have is treatment. There's regulations on what kind of treatment you have to do. And that is changing. Many of you may be aware that Holden Village has to install a filtration plant. And this is a result of quite an old law since the 80s, that there's been a surface water treatment rule that if you get your water from a surface source, in general, you have to filter it unless you can show that the watershed is adequately protected. Now, some of you people might be able to update us on Portland. Are they having to filter? Or are they remaining unfiltered?
They're living unfiltered.
Okay, so they somehow have gotten permission to remain unfiltered, and I don't know if that's Oregon laws.
Well, the watershed's right now. Yeah, and the watershed's protected. I mean, you can't go in the watershed.
Watershed's protected, but the filtering things come as an issue.
Yeah. Okay. And an issue with Portland is, too, is that as we get droughts in the summer here, where a lot of times you have not enough rain, And then if the water supply gets low enough, and then we do have wells that they go to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that makes it, that's helpful. Well, there's something like six major cities in the U.S. that don't have filtration. Seattle and Portland, I know, are two of them. I was involved in New York City in a big project to try and avoid filtration. That was our goal, to show that the farms were protecting the water supply well enough. That they won't have to filter, but they may end up filtering. I guess I find it surprising that Holden Village has to filter, because the water supply comes off of Copper Basin, and certainly nobody's living there. But I believe it's because of the wildlife that they have to, because of the risk of Cryptosporidium and Giardia.
Well, also probably to remove all of the turbidity and other matter from the water, and then they don't need as much chlorine.
Well, they don't. Yeah, that's true. But I don't think they would make them filter just to do that. But it all falls together. Did someone have a comment in back? Was it you?
I just said Boston is another. It's all.
Okay, Boston is another large system that has a protected enough watershed that they don't have to filter. But this, you know, there's a lot of EPA management here of all these cities that don't have to. But Holden, with its Copper Creek, does have to filter. So that's not based on any monitoring. It's not that they found something bad in Holden's water supply. There are just regulations that a community of this size using that kind of water has to use filtration among its treatments. They are, of course, already chlorinating, so we can be, you know, fairly confident. But chlorine doesn't get at some of the protozoa. That's what Giardia and Cryptosporidium are not bacteria, they're protozoa. And they form cysts, and chlorine can't kill them. So that's why the filtration. And there's one more that I had listed as a way that regulation, what sort of form of regulation, is that an operator needs to be certified for all public water supplies, and there again, including Holden. And I guess I just got thinking about that this afternoon, that Holden Village, with all these volunteers, I mean, many volunteers are very qualified, but some, you know, are amateurs and come up to do what they need to do. But because it's a public water supply, they have to have their water operators or their operations manager go down and take a course and take an exam somewhere out there, wherever they have to take it, so that they're certified, because that is part of our country's regulation system. And this is true even of small mobile home parks that are a public water supply. It's another way that we monitor. And the Safe Drinking Water Act of 1996 introduced a new thing that is just coming up, and I don't know if some of you have already gotten this in your water bill. It's called a Consumer Confidence Report, that for the first time, starting in 1999, it's a rule, but many systems have already started in 1998. They need to provide you at least once a year with a report on the quality of your water. Has anybody gotten recently a report from their water company on what's in the water? And where was that? Everett. Okay, so they're ahead. Okay, so they're a little ahead. And where else?
I mean, we're on.
I'm in Parkland, Washington,
okay.
Out of Tacoma. We have the second oldest mutual water company.
Okay.
And all of us are shareholders that are users of it.
Interesting. And they sent you out the report already. I mean, people could have started whenever they wanted. Since 96, they knew it was coming to be a rule. Some very progressive systems may have sent out such a report before 96. We've known about it since 96. And by the end of 98, or early in 99, they all need to report. They need to report on what the quality of water was in 1998. So I think that this is going to bring on some interesting new issues. For example, you are a resident of Happyville, USA. Some of you were at my session on Tuesday. Oops, now why was this?
Well, another thing too is the bottled water phenomenon, and
yeah,
the buying of bottled water people are buying now, plus these refrigerator water filtration systems.
Okay,
big business.
And so the question is, was your water already safe before you go through one of those things? And we can talk about that a little bit more. But I just wanted to say that this is sort of the kind of things that are going to be covered in a consumer confidence report. They might not be called consumer confidence report. In fact, every system can make these look like whatever they want. There's guidelines that came out from the American Water Works Association, but they can present it in any form that they want. First of all, they have to tell you your water source, Muddy Creek, if you know. And because many people don't know this. Many people, where I live in West Lafayette, Indiana, think we drink out of the Wabash River, when in fact we only have a big system of wells. So I'm amazed at how many people don't know where the water comes from. So that's one thing they have to provide. And then after that, they provide this long list of things that have been found in the water, okay? And this is where my sketch gets very rough, but I thought I would at least present it to you. Imagine that you're a consumer in the town of Happyville, and this comes in your water bill. There'd probably be a few more sentences than this, but sometimes there isn't. So you get split into categories like this, organics, volatile organics, synthetic organics, and we'll talk about that. What they're required to present is the average yearly value of each of these, and then what the maximum contaminant level, which is the drinking water maximum allowed. So they present what you actually had and then what you're allowed to have. Oops. Okay, and I don't know the values for some. I just wrote this up, but I just wanted to show you a few. Under inorganics, you'll find nitrate, and this is real typical, that the drinking water standard is 10 parts per million, and many systems will be up around 2 or 3. And then you'll have lead, arsenic, and there's a lot more inorganics that you'll have here. And you might have non-detect, something like that. The ND means non-detected. I don't know. There's some value. That's all inorganic chemicals. And most of those, you know, some words are scarier than others. Most of these things you know you don't want in your water, but, you know, they don't have such long words. Then you get to the volatile organic compounds, and that's the sort of solvents, gasolines. I wrote a few that I know are on here, chloroform, benzene. Benzene, I was just reminded today, was what was in Perrier water about 6 years ago, if any of you remember that there was benzene found. So that whole category has very strict limits on what it's allowed to have. And so I don't even have any numbers on my head because I don't work with solvents. I work more with pesticides. But you'd have some average level in your water, and then you'd have some maximum allowed. And then you get to the synthetic organic compounds, and that's where your pesticides fall. So this is where the farmers in Indiana are very worried when we tell them that starting next year, every consumer is going to see what the average level of everything like atrazine, the most commonly detected pesticide, is in their water. And if we do it in parts per million, these are the kind of numbers that you get. The drinking water standard is 0.003. Let's say Happyville had 0.002 parts per million of atrazine as their long-term average. So this, in fact, is not a violation of the drinking water standard. They would not have had to post it, you know, something in the newspaper or anything like that. But nonetheless, there is atrazine. Then you can go on through all the pesticides that are regulated. There's about 30 of them, maybe, that they're checking for.
Question I have, somebody gets this in their mails, and this going to alarm them?
Well, that's the question. Yeah. That's what we're going to talk about. So I'm just going to finish going through it, and then we're going to talk about what kind of feelings this generates in people. The other two large categories are the radionuclides, and I don't know that much about them, and then these bacterial kind of things. And so you'll have like a number of exceedances of the drinking water standard, which is one colony-forming unit per 100 milliliters, and then you'll have the number of times turbidity was exceeded, or something like that. They can present it however they want, but that's the kind of things that they need to present.
Okay. Add fluoride now, to your water, or fluoride?
Yeah, so that would probably be on here too, I would think, but that's not something that's regulated. So I'm not sure if fluoride goes on here because it's, unless it were over there. Okay, what I want you all to do is imagine this feelings thing. You are a citizen of Happyville, and the only thing you know about your water is that your water bill got raised, 5 years ago once, and you were all upset about it from, I don't know, what's a typical water bill? I was going to find this out before. Who pays a water bill? I have private water.
$82 for 2 months.
$82 for 2 months?
Yeah.
Gosh, that seems kind of high.
Yeah, that's right. That's
$40 a month?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that in the summer when we're watering?
Okay. So the only thing you knew before.
Right. We have runoff sewage, runoff.
All right. So you were mad a few years ago when your water bill went up, but you got over that. You've never heard anything else from your water. You turn it on and it comes out. And now, in your bill, you get this report of what's in the water. What might you feel?
Depends on the customer.
Depends if you recognize something like atrazine, if you knew what it was.
Well, that's yes, that's so true. Okay, let me just say here, some of you are here Monday. We're going to have another sort of role playing where you don't have to make up your own role, okay? If you're interested in reading one of the parts, let's say, one of the roles, I'm just going to get some, how some people might feel about these levels, okay? So if you're interested in reading one, take one. If you're not, just pass them on. Okay, yes?
I was going to say it would probably sell a lot of Brita water filters.
Yes, and I think that yeah, certainly would be.
I just moved to Bellevue, and this isn't a commercial. I don't have any stock in the company, but it improved the taste of the water considerably. The Bellevue water, I know it has too much, it's near Seattle, but it has too much chlorine in it or something. It just has a bad taste.
And that's exactly what Brita is. There's no doubt but that an activated carbon filter can improve the taste.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was just buying bottled water, and now I'm just drinking much more water because I don't have to keep going to the store and buying it.
That's very helpful.
It just tastes so bad.
Yeah, so taste is certainly part of our experience of water. I mean, people are very concerned about its safety usually, but they're certainly also concerned about its taste.
Sure,
and I think that's a good reason to buy a Brita.
It's gonna get other things out too, so.
Okay, these are some responses that I thought might take place in a conversation. And again, I've heard most of these feelings. When around this issue of the fact that there is atrazine in this public water supply. Okay, and atrazine is a herbicide. I guess I should explain more about that. It's a very commonly used herbicide, and herbicides, of course, are kinds of pesticides. They're not the most toxic kind of pesticides. An insecticide is going to be more toxic, but a herbicide is regulated, and there's an amount that has been found to be, quote, safe. We'll talk about that. And there's an amount that's allowed in your water. And the water, the amount found in Happyville's water supply was below the amount that has been found to be safe. But I think there's a lot of issues around what kind of conversations that might generate otherwise. So who's number one?
Well, I paid $25,000 for city water, and I expect it to be clean. The water company isn't doing its job, and we need to get together and complain. What are they doing with our money if they're not getting the water clean? We want pure water with no chemicals.
Okay, I think that's a very common thing I hear. If you can just read the top thing, she's a concerned consumer, but I don't have it here what each person is. You have to read what you are.
Before they send this out, I mean, it seemed to me they'd have to give, I mean, they just can't get it in the mail someday without some sort of public note, announcement.
Well, I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, because that's just going to alarm people, I'm guaranteed.
Well, they should send a letter with it, but they can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
Who's number two?
It's not the water
company. Can you say who you are first?
Oh, water company manager.
Okay.
It's not the water company's fault that water has pesticides, it's the farmers. They are using too many pesticides, which is a concern. And anyway, the water meets state and federal standards. So it meets the standards, and those standards will be determined if they're safe for human consumption.
Okay, number three. Can you say who you are?
I'm number three, I'm a farmer. We need pesticides to grow crops competitively in today's economy. Pesticides are regulated by the EPA, and I follow all regulations carefully. I apply only the amount I need to control weeds and insects.
Four.
This is the EPA official or the state pesticide regulatory agency official?
Okay, let me just add there because that might not be clear. The EPA has the overall responsibility for regulating pesticides, but within your state there is an agency. It's probably the Department of Agriculture. In Indiana we have a really weird agency, but whatever, it's the agency that EPA has given the pesticide regulatory responsibility to.
Okay. All pesticides used today have been extensively tested and found to have more benefits than risks for society. Water that meets the Safe Drinking Water Act standards adds a minimal cancer risk, and consumers should not be concerned.
Okay, and let me say, if you want to add anything to your, if you want to add to your part here, you can improvise. Feel free to do that. Okay, five.
I'm number five, a concerned consumer. I don't care if the benefit-cost ratio is positive. I want my children to drink pure water. Let's ban pesticide use in the area that flows to our water supply.
Okay, who's next? Six.
I'm a pesticide company official. No water is pure. The important question is, working with the farmers that use our products, to employ farming methods that keep the pesticides on the field and out of the water supply.
Okay, and seven, I think there's one more.
I'm an environmental organization,
yeah,
and I want you to know that cancer is not the only risk from pesticides. Widespread chemicals in the environment disrupt the hormone systems of animals, including humans. This newly discovered threat to public health needs to be considered in pesticide regulation, rather than simply whether they cause cancer or not.
All right, we got a lot of things going on here. I thought we'd just throw them all out and then see what kind of thoughts you have. This might be too many issues, but let's just review a little bit. We've got the consumers that say, we don't want any pesticides. First, one says it's the water company's fault. One says it's the farmer's fault for using pesticides. Let's ban pesticides. Then we have the studies from the, you know, and it's EPA's responsibility to compare the benefits and cost of these pesticides. And they have decided to leave the pesticides on the market, but they've gotten a level based on a very low added risk of cancer. It's like less than one in a million extra cancers will be formed if everybody drinks water for 70 years at this level. So they consider that to be an acceptable risk. And our regulation is all based on whether it's cancer-causing and what's the risk of cancer. Okay, so you've already got all this going on. You've got this big debate, are these levels acceptable? And you know, what can console the consumer that might be very concerned about it? Now the last one, I apologize, this is sort of adding one too many issues on, but I at least wanted you to be aware of a growing voice from many environmental organizations. The Natural Resources Defense Council has been a leader here, or the Environmental Defense, or the World Wildlife Fund, they're all basically behind this, which is to say that there's growing evidence that cancer is not the only threat from many of the pesticides and all kinds of chemicals in our environment. But there's actually this very subtle hormone disruption, you know, change in the endocrine system of animals, including humans, that they think is due to the wide variety of pesticides that are, and chemicals that were exposed to. And so that they would fault the EPA for saying, you may be looking at cancer, but cancer is not the only issue. You got to look at all these other things. And so therefore, that 0.003 parts per million, I don't believe that. It might be actually lower than that. Okay, so we've got a lot of different voices that are going on here. What would the rest of you say to add to this kind of a dialogue or conversation? I guess it's not a dialogue.
Well, I would say that the effects of that one thing might be measured to be that small, that the effect of all these things is cumulative on the health system and on our animals, too. You know, that, one little thing might not make the person have cancer, but if you add all these things together, all these radiations and chemicals and things in our food, add that to our water, then it does in the system.
Yes, and that's a very good point. And in fact, part of the new, I can't remember if it's in the Food Quality Protection or Safe Drinking Water Act, there's these two new rules that are sort of changing how pesticides are. But one of the things they've got is that all the pesticides that act on the body in the same way, or in fact all the chemicals that act on the same way, are supposed to be regulated together eventually. This is not the case yet. They're still completely separate, but that's the idea. Trying to get a little bit towards that idea, but probably not as far as you as a concerned consumer might think. Other thoughts?
Someone might say that these chemicals have been in the water all the time, but it's just because of government regulations that it's reported to us now, and they haven't done that much harm to us so far. But now that we're aware of them, maybe we can make some regulations about how these pesticides are used and make sure the farmers aren't using too much pesticides and make sure they're not getting into the water supply instead of banning them completely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think that's very constructive. Because on top of the voice of reason that you bring, most of these, well, it would have to be the EPA that bans them, at least in Indiana, and that's where I'm most familiar with. Though I have talked with many people that would like to ban pesticides in the watershed for their public water supply or in the area that supplies their well. They don't have the right as local people if the farmers are following the regulations, which is what the label says. Or if any of you who have ever applied pesticides to a lawn, let's say, you know, there's a label that comes with what you buy, right? And it might have a lot of warnings and everything. That is the law. That's not just sort of like good advice. That actually is the law. You are required to follow that. And that's the same for any farm chemical. You must follow that. But right, we can work with ways to reduce it, you know, probably without banning it. But it would only be the EPA itself that could take pesticides out of the market, which they certainly have the right to do. The EPA absolutely can do that.
Can I ask, is there any monitoring of following that those regulations for application? I mean, just as a public water system has to have someone who's a certified water operator, do pesticides have to have someone be certified to operate them in any kind of safe way? Or
yes, in fact, they do. Well, it's, you know, safety is not the thing, but I mean, not maybe the main thing, but they are. For there's a number of pesticides that are called restricted use pesticides, and those are the ones that you as consumers cannot buy. There are some things like Roundup. Any of us can go to Walmart or wherever we want to go and pick up Roundup. But the ones like atrazine that have been found to show up in water at levels that we don't want it to are called restricted use pesticides. And then farmers or whoever applies the pesticide has to go to a little course and pass the test and then do continuing education to have the right to apply it. Yes. But there isn't monitoring on whether he actually applies it safely. Nobody's really looking out for that. But he has gone through a course.
What I like to do is buy organic where I can. We have stores in Portland that have organic produce. And people go to those stores, so they buy produce that doesn't have pesticides on it.
Mm-hmm. And it's also a way of supporting.
Right. And so then hopefully there will be a critical mass at some point in time where maybe more can switch over. So.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that would be one of the results of all the, you know, consumer, the new reporting on what's in your water. I don't know. Do you think most people will read this or will they throw it away, the consumer confidence report?
Okay. Can I ask, do bottled water companies have to follow that then too? And what are the percentages of bottled water?
Okay, so well, let's turn to bottled water and treated water. Okay, I wanted to give enough discussion for that, but we can come back to it too. Bottled water is now subject to the same regulations. You should somewhere, I'm not sure where the bottled water results are posted. I don't think it needs to show up on every bottle, but maybe somewhere where you buy it or something. I'm not sure where it has to go. But it's only been the last couple of years that bottled water was subject to the same regulations as public water supply. That is to say, the level, the maximum level of, well, let's just take atrazine, but it could be anything of 0.003 parts per million. A public water supply, if they go over that, they have to, you know, inform you, they have to put a notice in the paper, they have to go to great lengths to take care of their problem. Bottled water never had to until a couple years ago, because they were regulated as a food by the Food and Drug Administration. They were not regulated by the EPA as public water. So it was quite ironic that many people were buying public water assuming that it's safer, and buying bottled water assuming that it's safer, but in fact the regulations were much less strict. Anybody to this day, as far as I know, can sell bottled water. You could take water out of your tap at home and bottle it and sell it. And that's indeed, well, I don't know if people take it out of their tap, but there are bottled water types that come right out of public water utilities, which for the most part is fine because that water is very good. Now, why people would pay for it is not particularly clear and lug it home from the grocery store, but that water can be assumed to be good. But there's a number of new regulations that came out lately. One, that it has to follow the same regulations as public drinking water supply. That was new. The second one is that if it says, for example, that it comes from a spring, it actually has to come from a spring. So that's new. Just to say, that did not used to be the case. You used to be able to call anything spring water. But let me just add here that spring water would be the least advisable type of water to buy, in my opinion. I mean, I think it came from the days when, you know, your choice was drinking out of the lake or you could get it from a spring, and a spring would be better. But now, that's going to mean groundwater that's very close to the surface and is certainly the most likely to be contaminated. So I would, you know, tend to stay away from spring water if possible. But some of the bottled water is treated water. It's specially treated. It's, for example, treated by reverse osmosis. That might be some that you've seen, mm-hmm. or some bottled water is distilled. In that case, you are going to get a purer water. It's going to have less stuff in it. The same as if you buy a reverse osmosis system or a distillation system or an activated carbon filter for yourself. For any of those, you are going to have a water that, you know, water that it gets out some of the stuff that's in it. The question is whether the stuff is harmful. One of the main reasons that people buy filters for water is just what you said. It's the taste of chlorine. Many people don't like that taste. Our water is required to have what's called a chlorine residual in it, and that's so that the chlorine kills all the bacteria in the water tank. You want it to do that, but they could just add the exact amount of chlorine that would kill the bacteria and then let it go. But they don't. They have to add more chlorine than that so that chlorine stays all through the pipeline, all through, you know, all the pipes throughout the city and into your house, so that if there's any bacteria lurking, say, inside your faucet, it kills that bacteria as it comes through. So it's required to keep up that level of chlorine. And for killing bacteria, you want that slightly higher level of chlorine. What the activated carbon filter does is take out the chlorine, which is fine. You don't need the chlorine, but it sets you up for potential contamination. If there's bacteria now lurking somewhere, you no longer have that chlorine residual to kill it.
Like if I put it in my water bottle and carry it in my car all day or something like that, it would be more apt to get bacteria growing in it than if I use tap water.
Right. And that's what they say. If you take a bottle and go to the store where you buy filtered water or something like that, you gotta be really careful to not contaminate it, not touch anything. Whereas, you know, if we touch a bottle of water to something, or tap water, it's no big deal because there is that chlorine residual. And where it especially is a problem is if you don't change your filter often enough. The filter itself provides a wonderful medium for bacteria, and so I'm sure when you bought it, they tell you how often to change it.
Two months.
Okay, so you assume that if you change it every 2 months, you're safe. But some people, you know how they are, they think, well, I'll just go a little bit longer, and the filters cost too much or something, I'll just go a little bit longer. That's what the problem is. It's still going to filter everything out, but it may be adding bacteria back in the process.
Question two on the bottled water, often in this number two plastic, do they get any contaminants from the bottle that they're in? Chemicals from?
And I think that would be regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, and I don't think that it does because we buy our milk and everything in that. I assume that that's tested by someone else.
No.
Uh-huh.
What has brought on the need for the chlorine lines in water? Because I've noticed that I keep tropical fish and the water systems that use chloramine, chlorine.
Chloramine, I think. Is that right?
Yeah,
I don't think they use it. Is that right? You just know that it's in there.
It's in the water.
Okay.
And that if it's not treated, it kills tropical fish.
Oh, that's interesting. Because this is the big new regulation that's coming down the pike and making a lot of water treatment systems very nervous. Is that they've now found for humans, I didn't know for fish, that there are definite cancer-causing effects of these chloramines. And it's a byproduct of adding chlorine to water that has some organic matter in it. I think that's what you're saying here, because there's a bunch of chlorine byproducts. Does that seem right? I think chloramine is one of them. Is that right? You're a chemist. Okay, that's right.
Chlorine is combined with them.
I think it's the organic matter itself, but they would probably be together. They would both be in the same kind of water. So it only happens in surface water. It doesn't much happen in groundwater. But this is going to be regulated. It's going down dramatically. What you're allowed to have this year is going to be a lot less that you're allowed to have next year, and it's going to be a lot less that you're allowed to have next year. And this is making people very nervous because they don't have a good way to get it out. They might have to do some more filtration than they're currently doing. But that's an example of something that they had no idea was harmful until quite recently. It wasn't that they knew it was bad and just weren't regulating it. They just didn't know. It's new public health studies that showed that was bad. So that's an example of something that, you know, the best scientists thought it was safe, but in fact, then they found that may be a problem. So that's another thing that the activated carbon filter would get out, these chlorine byproducts that are harmful if you have a surface water system. We have time for just a couple more questions.
We've known that about fish for years and years, though.
Is that right?
Yeah, the aquariums have that little dechlor stuff.
Is it the chlorine, or did they know it was the chloramine?
Oh, maybe it was chlorine. But the chlorine forms the chloramine.
So. Yeah, that's what the problem is.
But you have to leave it sit for 24 hours, or else you have to put some drops in, because otherwise, even goldfish die if you put them in chlorinated water.
Okay, obviously I don't keep fish. I only know that that's a big change in public drinking water. Do you have a comment back there?
Yeah, we're really concerned about very minute amounts of things in our water as Americans. And don't we have the most regulated and the least stuff in our water of practically any place in the world? And yet, all over the world, with the exception of epidemics following disasters and stuff, people are not dropping dead every day from drinking water from wherever it is they get it. And, you know, like, are we overreacting?
Well, let me think through a couple of those issues. I mean, in other countries, certainly there's a lot of gastrointestinal disease that's causing people to die, maybe slowly, you know. Diarrhea that causes dehydration, that's what they think most of the children that are dying needlessly is from. So it's very indirect, you know, you don't suddenly drop dead, but it's poor nutrition due to, you know, long-term illnesses. Whether we're overreacting, I don't know. See, I'm sort of a proponent of public drinking water. I think that the regulatory system is really quite remarkable. And let me add that it's very expensive, that we've decided that all the public drinking water needs to be drinkable. In many other countries, it's just assumed that it won't be. You wouldn't flush your toilet with drinking water. That seems kind of crazy. And you just treat your drinking water. We've decided that all the water needs to be drinkable. And gosh, we could have had an ethical discussion about that too. I think there's an advantage because it makes it available to the poor as well as to the rich. That any water you find on the street or whatever is going to be drinkable in this country. But we've made a very expensive decision by making it all so regulated and so pure. So I guess I would just close in response to that with a comment that I remember hearing from Carol Browner, the administrator of the EPA, on some presentation, but she closed by saying, every family, every household is going to have to decide for themselves how they, you know, whether they drink public water or treated water or bottled water. But as for me and my family, we choose public drinking water. Now, I don't know, for all you biblical people, at least that reminds me of something that we've heard before. As for me and my house, that's what we choose. But I think that we do have, for the most part, a very safe system. But there are good reasons for buying a filter if you want to improve the taste, for the most part.
I never had any trouble. I've moved here from Southern California. Near Pasadena, we had, in Arcadia, we had wells. We got water from the wells there. And I always drank that water and never had any problem with it. So it's, and other people said the same thing about the Bellevue water. It's just, you know, it changes the taste of everything. Coffee, orange juice.
Yeah, that's what they say for coffee purists. Yeah, well, it's 7:20, so I need to let people go if you need to leave. But we can continue talking to you. But it's 7:20. So thank you.